Sterling Newberry, you were the DraftClark.com blog who brought him into the race. When he surfaced as a candidate, suddenly there was trouble, and you wrote a famous blog entry. Do you remember your lead?
By the time you read this, the bell will be tolling for the Clark campaign. Across the country, people will know that it is merely the Gore campaign with a better candidate.
And suddenly you had a collision of the new politics and the old inside one campaign. Take this apart. What happened?
What happened is Wesley Clark came to prominence by standing for something before he ran for office. And out of the gate, all of the old baggage of the 2000 campaign was loaded on his shoulders, and suddenly he didn't stand for something anymore. There was something deeply amiss in how the Clark campaign was converting Clark the figure into Clark the candidate. Ironically, there was more discipline of message when Clark was a non-candidate than when he was a candidate, because when he was a non-candidate, everyone who was writing about Clark was forced to go back to Clark's words, his appearances, his speeches, his books, his articles. Once there was a campaign, there became a conflict because the message that the campaign wanted to put out was at odds with the ideology which Clark himself had stated. Clark said alliances, Clark said individual initiative, Clark said be your best. The campaign said we control the message, the campaign said we decide who's in and out, the campaign said we don't want to offend anybody, we don't want to say something which might cost us votes in the South Carolina primary. All of those things were completely at odds with how Clark had presented himself and his message and his meaning as a non-candidate, as a public figure. That's a problem because the people who were drawn into Clark were not political hacks. They were not longtime political activists. They were people who heard him on CNN, who read the book, and they felt he was speaking directly to their aspiration for a better America, for a better politics, by being better people. And the campaign did not follow through on that message.
Is it possible you can have, in a modern campaign, free voices speaking in all different directions about the same candidate?
It's necessary. Look at what's happened to computer programming with what's called open source software. It's not software which is built by a single company, which hides the source code and hides the details and hides how things work. And if you want something changed, you write a letter in and you pray and you hope that they assign a programmer to it. In the world of open source software, there's a center. People push things into the center. The center decides what fits, but it then pushes the programming back out. In open source politics, message comes into the center. The center processes it, makes it whole, puts it together, makes it coherent, gives it an expression, and then pushes it back out again. It's not just possible. It's necessary. It's the way we are reorganizing our society at this moment, and it's going to reorganize politics, too, for the same reasons.
Are you still in the Clark campaign?
I was never a member of the Clark campaign. I am still a member of the Clark movement, and I tell every reporter I talk to, you're talking to the hardest of hardcore Clark supporters.
Where was that letter coming from?
The letter was coming from an overwhelming sense of frustration that many people had. They did not feel, and I did not feel, that we could get a message into the center of the campaign. The phone lines were manned by a very small group of people who had their own agenda. The email addresses belonged to a very small group of people who had their own agenda. And
typical campaign.
What's not typical is that those people did not report back upwards to the people who they were supposedly working for.
Sterling Newberry, there were in fact several Draft Clark blogs and movements. How was that transition going to go when suddenly somebody had to schedule the candidate, raise the money, set the direction?
The richness of the Clark movement goes well beyond a number of blogs. You've talked with Harold Bloom. There are reporters like Franklin Foer of the New Republic. There are reporters like Joshua Micah Marshall. The Clark movement was always large and diverse because the ideas that Clark presents are large and diverse. That was part of the power, the resonance, the authenticity, was you weren't getting flackery people repeating the same things over and over again. You were getting thousands of individual voices who looked at the same figure, read the same words, and were able to put those words in terms that their place in society, whether they are a Yale academic, a young, sharp reporter, a political blogger, a man on the street, a woman from Maine, all of these people could put Clark in their own terms. That's what made it powerful. When we were a draft movement, we were very good at sharing information, sharing technical accomplishments, sharing ideas. We used each other's ideas. We learned from each other. Again, to get back to the Clue Train Manifesto, networked electorates, become smarter, faster than campaigns do. And if campaigns can bring in their networked electorate, they suddenly have thousands and thousands of people who can do more than carry signs and wear T-shirts and hand out candy bars. Those are still important to the campaign. They have thousands and thousands of part-time professionals who can contribute a day of professional labor to the campaign, labor that you would otherwise have to go out and pay expensive political consultants in expensive offices in Washington to do for you.
Let's talk about the Iowa caucuses, because it comes to a crunch there. Wesley Clark bails out of Iowa because he thought he didn't have time to do the very personal retail campaigning that those caucuses require. If he'd asked you whether we stay in Iowa or bail, what would you have told him?
I would have told him, make Iowa the test case for the new politics. Make Iowa the place where the ability of people to become sophisticated conveyors of the Clark message and campaign for you, do the personal campaigning for you, teach them how to campaign for Wesley Clark, make them into leaders. That's no lose. It would be a feel-good democracy story. He comes in third, he comes in fourth. It doesn't matter. There's a week of great stories coming out of Iowa of people talking to reporters and having something to say, which is rich and sophisticated and sounds and feels like a campaign, even though they're not getting their talking points from Little Rock. Clark has a network of people who believe in Wesley Clark's message in a way that people do not believe in Kerry's message, in Lieberman's message, or John Edwards' message.
But Sterling, are there enough bloggers in Iowa, enough people online at all, to sustain a Clark campaign?
There's a very important marketing book called The Influentials that a very small percentage of the American population tells their fellow consumers what's good, what's working, what's ready for prime time. This computer, it's not ready. I like it, but it's too much trouble yet. The internet is where the political influentials are congregating, the people who will tell 10 people, and those 10 people will tell 10 more people. Each person that you get on the internet represents another 100 people who will be drawn into the sphere around the candidate, the movement around the candidate. That's what changes. Kerry has a lot of people who respect him, who respect his record, who like what he does, but they don't generate force. They don't persuade other people. Dennis Kucinich has a lot of people who are very active, but they don't talk to anyone else. It was Clark and Dean who generated people who got up from the computer and went out and talked to reporters, talked to politicians, talked to their neighbors, talked to their Democratic state committees, their Democratic local committees, to other people who were voters, to school committee members, to the man on the street, and said, this man must be president.
What's your definition of the magic multiplier in the internet? It's still a small percentage of the country, the electorate, that's online.
The difference is that the people who are deciding what the images are coming to the internet. 10 years ago, everyone formed their image of what was happening in the society by what they saw on television and what they read in a few major publications. Now, many of the people who are writing the headlines, writing the stories, making the political decisions, pushing the news, go to the internet to get what's happening. They look for how do people feel. It's their zeitgeist meter. It's no longer what's playing in Time magazine. Their zeitgeist meter is what's playing on Atrios' blog or the Daily Kos or on the conservative side on Drudge and Instapundit. Where people form their opinions has changed. The people who are manufacturing, who are creating the artifice of opinion is now on the internet, and that means it expands outwards. Reporters don't trust what they read in the New York Times. They trust what they can find online and research online and dig into what's really going on.
Can we explain why?
The magic of the internet is, and it's the word you used, authenticity. And authenticity is more than what's real. Authenticity is what cannot be faked, what works. 100 people writing a boilerplate email is not authenticity. That's AstroTurf. A blog, however badly done, represents somebody who took time out of their day to set things up and put their own personal stamp on what is going on. People are willing to take the time to write and assemble and link and quote is an excellent indicator of what people are willing to spend their time doing. And that's how society runs. Things that people are willing to take time out of their day or every week to do. That's how a church works. That's how a community works. That's how a school works. What are people willing to do every single day? what's part of their lives, what's woven into the fabric of their existence. The Internet's an indicator of what people are willing to do every single day.
Sterling Newberry, explain how the Internet suddenly got here. People have been betting on the Internet, waiting for an Internet transformation for 10, 15 years, and losing a whole lot of money. Suddenly, it seems to be here. What happened?
The two changes that have happened in the last year. One, the Internet no longer needs to be manipulated by geeks. A person who does things can get to the Internet and put out their message in a polished, professional, usable form without having to learn a big, thick book of teach yourself
HTML.
Obscure, today's obscure arcane programming language in 24 hours. That's the first change. The technology has become more transparent. The way in 1920, if you wanted a radio, you ordered a kit, you assembled it. If a tube burned out, you took it apart, you ordered the tube, you put it in place, you played with it. In 1932, if you wanted a radio, you went out to Sears Roebuck, you bought a radio. That's the change between 1920 and 1932 in the radio. The second change, however, is a change in the society. The society wants forward movement. We no longer have a politics of complacency. The budget can be solved next year. The environment can be solved next year. Foreign policy can be solved next year. Today, let's fight over our one little issue in gridlock. The society and the technology rammed head on, and Iraq was the spark that changed politics because a huge fraction of the country said, we never voted for this. We never wanted this. We went to our representatives. They all voted for this. It was a headlong rush. It was a blank check. What happened? It was no longer the 10% of the population that's against all wars under any conditions, under any circumstances. It was 50% of the population who said, maybe I would have voted for a war in Iraq, but I didn't vote for this war this way, this time. Why wasn't I listened to? Why were the doors shut? And that's what drove the explosion of politics on the Internet. And it was into that moment that two figures stepped, Howard Dean and Wesley Clark. And both of them spoke to the large section of America that was very, very troubled about the rush to judgment and the way we did things. They were not pacifists. They were not disarmament buffs from way back. They were hard-headed, centrist political figures. One had run a war. One said, I've supported every intervention until this one. Into that environment stepped a group of people who were saying, what were our options? What choices do we have? We never felt we had a choice. We just had this, there's weapons of mass destruction. There could be a mushroom cloud over New York City. We've got to go in. We've got to do this. We can't take a chance. We know he's bad. We know he's dirty. We know he has the program. We know he has tons and tons and tons of chemical stocks. We have to do it before he sells them to Al-Qaeda. And it was kind of the pitch that just rolled over everybody. And then in the wake of the invasion, people said, there weren't weapons of mass destruction. There was no program. We didn't go in because he had weapons of mass destruction. We went in because he didn't. We didn't go in because he was a threat. We went in because he wasn't. We were lied to. What happened? Why was there this rush to judgment? And because there was no outlet through the establishment media, there was no channel which this voice could speak in a coherent fashion, because the establishment media had reduced the story down to anti-war people carrying signs the way they have for 30 years, and hard-headed political realists. We have to vote with the hard-headed political realists. Suddenly, the hard-headed political realists didn't look realistic. It looked like a huge boondoggle, which was unnecessary, and, as Wesley Clark said, optional surgery. And that was the explosion, when you had people who had supported the idea of a war saying, I didn't support this war. And that, to get to a larger point that I really want to get to, is the deep change that's happening on the Internet. It's the rebirth of Main Street America. 10 years ago, the Internet was the wrong side of the tracks. It was the industrial park where technical people talked about technical things. It was the sewer system of our financial infrastructure where banks talked to each other about which checks had been cashed. And it was the seedy side of town where people went to barroom brawls to yell about things that frustrated them and look for seedy things that they couldn't find in the light of Main Street America. The Internet's changed. My grandmother is on the Internet and reads news on the Internet. My mother is a teacher. She reads political news off the Internet. Main Street America is no longer simply pushing back on a pyramid that's raining message down on them. It's saying, we have coherent ideas and we want to be heard in full. We want to be people again that are three-dimensional and have the ability to articulate complex political ideas. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to communicate with my representative by more than a 10-word telegram and a 3-word bumper sticker. That's the change, the rebirth of Main Street America on the internet.
Pick up the Clark story. The bloggers draw him in. The old-timers take over the campaign. How does it come out?
Well, the story with what happened with the Clark campaign can be summarized this way. They grabbed a whole bunch of people, friends hired friends, and they ended up with a campaign which is a collection of people who happened to know each other rather than being the best people who were available. And that's a problem that was reflected at the top of the campaign and at the bottom of the campaign as well. So you had a group of people who were defending not just what they did, but the fact that their core should be completely in charge of whatever it is they were doing. This kind of insiderly nature created a fundamental conflict.
Why was the departure from the Clark campaign of Donnie Fowler, son of a former National Committee chairman, South Carolina veteran, why did Donnie Fowler's departure mean so much?
Donnie Fowler is a person who has a foot in the old political world and in the new economy. He understood how to bridge these two worlds. He understood that he was running a startup company, and he had to impose the startup discipline. The reason his departure was the trigger is because it was a sign that the people who I call the entrepreneurs, the people who get where they're going because they have inside connections, had made an agreement that they were going to sandbag the startup discipline that was being imposed on the economy of that campaign. This was a sign that things were turning in the wrong direction and that the wrong people had exacted a price. I have enormous respect for Mr. Fowler's work, and the fact that he quit in disgust was a sign that the tensions in the campaign were reaching the boiling point and that there was going to be a cost when those pressures reached the public. That, for me, was the trigger to say, we need to put out what we know is wrong inside the campaign, the small mistakes that are adding up to big problems, the mistakes which today, while everybody is euphoric and drunk on 20% poll numbers and $250,000 a day in campaign contributions, are going to be ignored, but in 6 weeks' time, when you have to put people on the ground to get on the ballot in New York State, when you have to put people on the ground to get the caucuses going in Iowa, are going to be politically painful. It's time to go with that. It's time to tell people there's been a fundamental change in politics. The old politics cannot structure this campaign. It's impossible. It's impossible for the old politics to win the House of Representatives back. Ask the old-time strategists. They will tell you it's impossible. The only way to go is forward. And the open letter was, and I didn't think of it this way at the time, it was a manifesto for it isn't a risk to do things a new way because the old way will not work. And that was the moment to put that forward, and that was the moment to have people look at that, because many reporters wanted to say this but didn't want to be the person to bell the cat.
So then what? The fire's put out. He's raising a lot of money. He's got good poll standing. Where does it go from here?
Well, where it's gone has not been good. First of all, the second national poll to come out after Wesley Clark is a candidate shows him dropping from 20% to 13%, and that's the Fox News poll. 7% in 2 weeks is a lot of people, and it shows that the campaign was unable to convert the bounce of his announcement into permanent support. That's a sign of a campaign that isn't doing its job. The continued infighting, the lack of a campaign manager, the lack of a political director, the lack of cohesive communication between the top of the campaign and the bottom of the campaign, The inability to take stands on important issues, which are signature issues. Wesley Clark came to public prominence by saying, I can handle Iraq better than the president can. That's what he came to prominence on, and yet he doesn't have a position on the $87 billion program that's been put forward to Congress. That makes no sense. The first days after the campaign had fumbles and missteps, the help me marry moments, but what's happened since has not managed to define Wesley Clark and separate him from the pack. His programs look like the other Democratic candidates. He wants to roll back the tax cuts on upper income earners. Every Democrat has said he wants to do that. He hasn't distinguished himself, and that's a sign that, of a campaign that doesn't understand the fundamental nature of Clark's appeal, that he is a fine, bright, sharp sword who cuts through the muddle of large policy promises which no one reads and no one understands, the muddle of media promises made to be broken, phrases that mean nothing and go nowhere. The Clark campaign has not managed to take this instrument, the most brilliant political candidate as a candidate in this election, and turn that appeal into a rolling wave. What should have happened was Clark announces he goes to 20% in the national polls. He then puts forward a series of key bullet points. He goes to 25% in the national polls. He then turns around and says, I am the front runner. I have separated myself from the pack because I am about the leadership that America demands, the hunger for Americans to have leadership and to be leaders again. He goes from 25 to 30% in the polls and proceeds to turn that into a sense of inevitability, the aura of invincibility. The campaign did not build on Wesley Clark's appeal, his power, and his charisma, and create that aura of invulnerability. And one reporter said to me, we're going to try and go after him now because we can. We know we can do it. We know we can put the dings in the armor. That is a very important change, and it's a huge loss. It's a lost opportunity that you will never get back.
So what are we learning here about the relation of candidate to movement, of one man to a mass?
The candidate is the bearer of the message in the media world. He is the speaker of the words. In the new politics, what is as important is that the candidate is the icon of authenticity. He is an example of his philosophy in action. Hmm. He is proof that his philosophy works. Dean has become a Deanite. Clark has to embrace the very transformation which he outlined, which he proselytized for, because that is the way that people will see the Clark that reached out to them, who presented them with the aspect of nobility returning to politics. His campaign needs to be a reflection of that nobility. He needs to be Achilles, and his campaign needs to be the Hellenes, the best and the brightest warriors with the shining shields that are going forth into battle. One political writer called it NATO on the net, that kind of resonance that led John Lincoln, one of the leaders of the draft movement, to say, this is the man who's the president we were promised as a kid. That sense of restoration of the shining, bright, hopeful, optimistic America. Because in America, it's the party of optimism that is the party of government. And Clark has to be not merely the speaker, he has to be the bearer of the message.
Can a young campaign on the move learn from these mistakes? Is there room for recovery in this game?
There's room for recovery, but what has to happen is that Wesley Clark has to put his stamp on this organization. He has to make it reflect his ideals, his values, his words. The candidate has to be an example of how to deal with problems, just as Howard Dean has become an iconic figure for people in his movement who are asking themselves constantly, what is the way we do things here? And that's true of great corporations and great organizations. They reflect an ideal. Control, top-down control, will get people to behave according to a script, but you can't script life, you can't script the new politics, and it is the unscripted moments that determine success or failure, your ability to respond to the question that nobody thought was going to be important a week ago. Yes, there is room to learn, but the person that the Clark campaign needs to be learning from is Wesley Clark, in the way he handled, for example, the National Training Center, and the way he wants to handle training of teachers, and the way he handled NATO, where he created connections and made it so that everybody who was attached to NATO had a stake in the decisions and a stake in the success. The person that they have to learn from is Wesley Clark, and the campaign does not look and feel like a Wesley Clark operation.
Sterling Newberry, this is an interesting conversation. We're going to continue it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lydon.